Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141-772-3976. That's 0141-772-3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of December 2023, from the Culture section. Scottish University's Dubai campus opened by Humza Yousaf and King Charles. This article is written by Lucy Garcia. First Minister Humza Yousaf has joined global leaders to set out Scotland's ambitions and objectives for COP28. At an opening of a university science campus in Dubai. Yousaf attended the official opening of the new Heriot Watt Dubai campus alongside King Charles to showcase Scotland's influential higher education sector. Foreign Secretary Lord David Cameron also attended, with the UK government sponsoring a clean tech exhibition at the summit. Yousaf and the King spoke to engineers and students at the new Dubai campus of Heriot Watt University, based in Edinburgh, and were shown a host of technologies designed to combat climate change. The First Minister said the campus helped showcase the leading role Scotland is playing in finding solutions for the biggest challenges facing the planet. Yousaf also met with Global South partners and youth activists to discuss priorities for COP28. Yousaf said, "I am proud of Scotland's leadership in advocating for climate justice and progressing a just transition to net zero. So it is fitting the official opening of Heriot Watt University campus in Dubai takes place on the first day of the world's largest global climate conference. This new campus will play a leading role in demonstrating the skills and ideas we have in Scotland to help find solutions for the biggest challenges facing the planet. The ambitions, enthusiasm and dedication of young people around the world are crucial in tackling climate change and advocating for climate action. Globally, we need to harness this energy and ensure we are using our collective talent, innovation and enthusiasm too. The Scottish Government will continue to call for loss and damage funding that prioritises the needs of vulnerable communities and take a lead on addressing the biodiversity and the climate crisis. I am confident these shared ambitions will be keenly felt by those who attend this vital climate summit and at home." Heriot Watt University opened its Dubai campus in 2005 at the Dubai International Academic City. The new campus aims to offer students the opportunity to focus on key areas including industrial decarbonisation and energy transition, which are key to delivering a just transition to net zero. That article was written by Lucy Garcia. This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of December 2023. From the news section. Former Labour Chancellor Alistair Darling dies aged 70. This article is written by Abby Garton Crosby. Former Labour Chancellor Alistair Darling has died aged 70 after a short illness, his family have confirmed. Darling served as Chancellor of the Exchequer under Gordon Brown from 2007 to 2010. The veteran Labour MP passed away after being treated for cancer at Western General Hospital in Edinburgh, it was announced on Thursday. Born in London, Darling went to the independent Loretto School in Musselburgh and graduated from the University of Aberdeen in 1976 with a legal degree, later becoming a solicitor. He first entered politics as a councillor on Lothian Regional Council in 1982, later elected as an MP for Edinburgh Central in 1987. Darling was one of the figureheads of the Better Together campaign during the independence referendum in 2014, notably going up against the SNP leader and First Minister Alex Salmond in televised debates. A statement issued on behalf of his family said, "The death of Alistair Darling, a former Chancellor of the Exchequer and long-serving member of the Labour Cabinet, was announced in Edinburgh today. Mr. Darling, the much-loved husband of Margaret and beloved father of Callum and Anna, died after a short spell in Western General Hospital under the wonderful care of the cancer team. Darling served as a Labour MP from 1987 to 2015 and was Chancellor during the financial crisis of 2008. He retired from the House of Lords in 2020, just 5 years after being appointed a life peer. Politicians from across the political spectrum, including Humza Yousaf, Alex Salmond, Gordon Brown, Patrick Harvey and Jeremy Hunt, paid tribute as the news broke on Thursday afternoon. The First Minister wrote, "I am deeply saddened to hear of Alistair's passing. He dedicated his life to public service and was a giant of Scottish politics. My thoughts are with his wife Margaret, children, family, friends and colleagues at this sad time." Meanwhile, former Labour Prime Minister Brown praised his role in the Better Together campaign. He said in a statement, "As the chair of the Better Together campaign for the 2014 Scottish referendum, he was resolute and courageous in making the case for Scotland's place in the United Kingdom. He was held in the highest esteem by me and all who worked with him for the way in which he handled the fall of the major banks and negotiated international agreements with fellow finance ministers. I, like many, relied on his wisdom, calmness in a crisis, and his humour." Foreign Secretary David Cameron, who was Tory leader while Darling dealt with the global financial crisis as Chancellor, said the Labour politician was a thoroughly kind and decent man. As Prime Minister, Cameron was in Number 10 during the Scottish referendum campaign, in which Darling played a leading role. He said, "We owe him a huge debt of gratitude for chairing the Better Together campaign ahead of the referendum in 2014. He led the campaign with great distinction and tenacity, securing Scotland's place in our union. He has left us far too early. My thoughts and prayers are with Maggie and his children, Callum and Anna." Former Better Together campaign chief Blair McDougall, who was selected to run as a Labour general election candidate earlier this week, paid tribute on behalf of the group. In a statement, he said that Darling was more than just a comrade in arms and was truly loved by the whole team. He was calm, wise, and perhaps surprisingly for someone with such a sober public image, incredibly funny and warm, it read. He was the tall tree under which we all sheltered in an often turbulent campaign. We knew as a team we were protected by him, and we felt such loyalty towards him in return. McDougall added that Darling was leader of the longest and arguably most important political campaign in UK history. "Our campaign strategy was based on the knowledge that we would be led by someone who personified the seriousness of the choice people placed," he said. "In an age when politics could seem so small and petty, he was a giant." That article was written by Abby Garton Crosby. This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of December, 2023, from the news section. Glasgow formally declares housing emergency amid increase in homelessness. This article is written by Craig Payton. Scotland's biggest city has declared a housing emergency as the council expects an increase in homelessness cases. Members of Glasgow City Council's City Administration Committee voted for the declaration on Thursday, following the decision of the UK government to streamline its asylum process. The Home Office is expected to make 2,500 decisions on asylum seekers in Glasgow by the end of the year. After a positive decision, residents are given 28 days to vacate the housing they were in as asylum seekers, and many resort to seeking help from the local authority. Since the streamlining came into effect in June, there has been a stark increase in the number of homelessness referrals of former asylum seekers by the Mears Group, which initially provides them with housing. Since August, the first full month where applications for homelessness support could be made for those who received their decisions in June, there have been 575 applications, compared to the 425 between that point and the beginning of the year. Alan Casey, the city's convener for Workforce, Homelessness and Addiction Services, said, "There is no doubt that the pressures we are facing constitute an emergency. We agree with partners that we urgently need resources to help us deal with these added pressures. We also need the UK government to pause their unconscionable asylum batching decision, which is already increasing homelessness and destitution, until they work with us to put a proper plan in place and commit to fully funding their decision." As our report outlines, referrals from Mears, the company which currently provides accommodation for those waiting asylum decisions here in Glasgow, have doubled in recent months. The city is experiencing an overwhelming increase in people presenting as rough sleepers, as well as a significant rise in individuals from elsewhere in the UK seeking assistance here in Glasgow. A UK government spokeswoman said, "We are committed to ensuring asylum claims are considered without unnecessary delays. Once someone is informed that their asylum claim has been granted, they get at least 28 days' notice to move on from their asylum accommodation. Support is offered to newly recognised refugees by Migrant Help and their partners, which includes advice on how to access universal credit, the labour market, and where to get assistance with housing. We are working with local authorities to help communities manage the impact of asylum decisions as the legacy backlog reduces." The decision by Glasgow councillors comes after MSPs rejected a Scottish Labour push to declare a housing emergency across the country earlier this month. A motion at Holyrood was defeated by 63 votes to 51. Edinburgh City Council and Argyll and Bute Council have already declared a housing emergency. On Thursday, councillors in Edinburgh published a draft action plan with 25 proposals for alleviating the issue the city faces, including working more quickly to make void homes ready for occupancy and buying off-the-shelf homes for use. If approved by councillors at a meeting on Tuesday, more detailed proposals will be put before the local authority in February. Meanwhile, Argyll and Bute Council held an emergency summit this week, which was attended by more than 90 partner organisations, where a commitment was made to increase the number of homes, including affordable ones, in the council area. The authority will publish its own action plan early in the new year. That article was written by Craig Payton. This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of December, 2023. From the news section. More than a third of households in fuel poverty in energy-rich Scotland. This article is written by Steph Braun. More than a third of households are in fuel poverty in energy-rich Scotland, shocking new statistics have shown. Figures from National Energy Action, NEA, show that around 850,000, that's 34%, are in fuel poverty, while more than 500,000, 23%, are in extreme fuel poverty. The findings have led to fresh calls for the Scottish Parliament to be given powers over energy by Westminster. Polling by NEA also found that of the 49% of adults in the UK that had turned their heating off, even though it was cold over the last 3 months, Scots were more likely to say they had done so. This is all while Scotland produces 6 times more gas than it consumes, and 2/3 of its electricity comes from renewable sources in Scotland. Dave Dugan, the SNP's energy spokesperson, said the statistics were horrifying. He said, "This is the consequence of decades of failed energy policy from Westminster governments we haven't voted for. For too long, the UK Treasury has raked in the profits that Scotland's natural resources have generated, while seeing nothing in return. We saw it again with the recent autumn statement. The Westminster government failed to use the profits to give families in Scotland a £400 energy rebate. If Westminster won't act, it must devolve energy and welfare powers to Scotland, so we can. It is clear that only with the full powers of independence can we chart our own course to green growth in a wider European market. Scotland has the energy, we just need the powers." The poll showed that of the 41% of UK prepayment customers who were self-disconnected over the last 3 months, Scottish households with prepayment meters were more likely to say they had done this. And of the 43% of UK adults who had gone to bed to stay warm over the last 3 months, Scots were more likely to say they had done so. The SNP called for action from the UK government last month as data revealed the 3 parliamentary constituencies facing the highest average increase in energy bills were in Scotland. Orkney and Shetland, Ross, Skye and Lochaber faced the highest average increases in energy bills, with £227, £219 and £206 respectively. The Glasgow Central seat was also 12th on the list, with an increase expected of £154 on average per household. At the other end of the scale, Esher and Walton, Chesham and Amersham and Beaconsfield in the south of England are set to see an average drop in prices of £159, £157 and £150. That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday the 1st of December 2023 from the news section. New law will help blight of raptor persecution in Scotland. This article is written by Neil Pooran. A new law will help to end the blight of raptor persecution on Scottish grouse moors, a minister has said. Environment Minister Gillian Martin said the new licensing scheme would target wrongdoers who give grouse moors a bad name. On Thursday, MSPs debated the general principles of the Wildlife Management and Muirburn Bill, which would regulate the grouse shooting industry and bring in a code of practice for land management. It would also restrict the practice of muirburn, the controlled burning of heather and other plants. Martin said Holyrood had a proud record of protecting the natural environment, urging MSPs to back the bill at stage one. She said the issue of raptor persecution has not gone away since the independent Werrity review at the end of 2019. Professor Alan Werrity had said a licensing scheme should be introduced if there is no marked improvement in the ecological sustainability of grouse moor management within 5 years. She referred to the disappearance of Merrick, a satellite tagged Golden Eagle, which vanished in Scottish borders on Monday. Martin said, "Grouse moors can be successfully managed in a way that doesn't negatively impact on the environment or biodiversity, and a great many of them are acting responsibly. But we need to end the blight of raptor persecution that takes place on the few estates that give the sector a bad name. She said the licensing scheme aimed to change the culture of grouse moor management while allowing law-abiding moors to continue. However, the Conservatives' Rachel Hamilton said the legislation would have a serious impact on the rural economy. She said, "We want to reiterate that we condemn the persecution of raptors, but the bill goes way beyond that objective." Hamilton said the minister would need to make changes to the plans in order to create a workable system, and questioned whether each case of raptor persecution was connected to grouse moors. She added, "The bill ignores rural voices and goes much further than its intentions." Following the debate, MSPs backed the general principles of the bill by 82 votes to 32. That article was written by Neil Pooran.
This is from The National on Monday, 4th December, 2023. From the News section. Ice rink conditions as Scottish weather warning issued. By Xander Elliards. People have been warned of possible injuries and travel disruption after a weather warning was issued for almost the entire eastern half of Scotland. The Met Office's yellow warning for snow and ice stretches from the Borders to Orkney, with experts warning drivers to look out for very treacherous icy conditions after another night of sub-zero temperatures. A second yellow weather warning for ice is in place across much of the north of England until noon on Monday, with further warnings for snow covering high ground in Wales and the Peak District until the same time. Overnight temperatures, which dipped to around or below freezing in many of the affected areas, were expected to cause icy patches on untreated surfaces due to thawed snow refreezing. RAF breakdown spokesperson Simon Williams said northern parts of the country could be facing an ice rink Monday as snow refreezes overnight. He said, "We are expecting some very treacherous icy conditions in northern parts, so those who have to drive should exercise great caution. If it's possible to delay or even abandon journeys, that may well be the best option. Those who decide to drive should leave extra space behind the vehicle in front, reduce their speeds to give plenty of time to stop. Before setting out, it's important to allow more time to de-ice and de-mist vehicles thoroughly." ScotRail advised passengers to check their journey before leaving home and warned that platforms may be icy. The Met Office has also issued a yellow warning for heavy rain, creating disruption to travel across parts of southern England, south-east Wales and into the Midlands, which will last until 6 p.m. The warning was extended on Monday west to include more of Devon and Somerset. Electricity North West said it was making hot food available at Green Nod Service Station in Ulverston on Monday morning for customers who remained without power. On Sunday evening, they said 1,500 properties in Cumbria remained without electricity after power cuts followed heavy snow in the county. The electricity network provider said it restored power to 7,500 homes, adding that access continues to be a major issue and even specialist 4x4 vehicles cannot reach all sites, with equipment for repairs being carried on foot in some locations. It added that Cumbria's power network had been severely impacted by the snow, with more than 35 separate damages to the network reported, including severe damage to miles of overhead lines. Cumberland Council said nearly 40 schools would remain closed on Monday due to the conditions. The UK Health Security Agency and the Met Office have issued amber cold health alerts in 5 regions: the East Midlands, West Midlands, North West, North East and Yorkshire and the Humber until December 5th, meaning cold weather impacts are likely to be felt across the whole health service for an extended period of time. England and Wales was expected to be largely cloudy outside the warning areas on Monday, with outbreaks of rain, some of them turning heavy. Overnight snow was predicted to be confined largely to the northeast and on hills, with frost and ice in the north and northwest. The Met Office said rain and hill snow will gradually ease across England and Wales on Tuesday, with brighter spells developing. It will be sunnier but cold elsewhere, with a few wintry showers in the northeast. Lighter winds for most. After frost and fog clears for bright spells on Wednesday, wet and windy weather is expected to arrive from the southwest, pushing north and east into Thursday and Friday, with some initial hill snow. That article was by Xander Elliards. This is from The National on Monday, 4th December 2023, from the Politics section. Scottish council leaders warn of cuts in plea ahead of Scottish budget, by Lucy Garcia. Council leaders in Scotland have warned without improvements in council funding, tough choices could mean essential services they provide will cease. Local government body COSLA also said there is a risk of bankruptcy for local authorities if funding provided by the Scottish Government is not improved. The comment was made after Birmingham and Nottingham City Councils effectively declared themselves bankrupt. Both authorities have issued Section 114 notices, which prevent spending on virtually everything apart from statutory services. In a briefing paper published ahead of the Scottish Budget on December 19th, COSLA said there is a risk this becomes the reality for Scottish councils if the funding by Scottish Government does not match growing cost pressures. To deal with the impact of inflation and the council tax freeze announced by the First Minister, Hamza Youssef, without first informing local authority leaders, COSLA said councils need almost £14.4 billion in the 2024-25 budget to stand still. No details have emerged on how much money local authorities will get to compensate for the council tax freeze, but the Scottish Government has insisted the policy will be fully funded. COSLA said, last year, councils faced a £1 billion funding gap just to keep services going. This year, there have been increased costs and greater demand on services, meaning councils have had to prioritise spend away from libraries, community and leisure centres. Spokesperson Katie Hagman added, sadly, our reality right now is an extremely challenging financial climate, coupled with years of real-term cuts to council budgets, while additional policy commitments are continually being introduced. If this situation doesn't start to improve soon, it will mean tough choices being made and the many essential services councils currently provide will cease. Services that not only address problems on the ground, but actively prevent bigger issues occurring down the line. She said COSLA has been clear that cutting frontline staff isn't the answer, and without adequate and sustainable funding, councils will not be able to help tackle poverty, support efforts towards net zero, or provide sustainable public services. COSLA insisted that every pound invested in local government has the potential to generate savings elsewhere across the public sector, for example in health and criminal justice. Its president, Shona Morrison, said, councils really are the key to unlocking the best for our communities, from safe, quality housing to clean streets, to supporting the most vulnerable people to thrive, to education and social care. The importance of these services cannot be emphasised enough, but they need to be funded properly. With councils having no choice but to protect core statutory services, Morrison said the unprecedented financial challenges we're all experiencing mean there are risks to many other local services our communities rely on, such as programmes supporting children and young people, sports and leisure facilities, and public transport. She added, "The campaign we're launching today clearly illustrates not only the challenges our councils are facing, but the great potential they have if funded properly. We will continue to work closely with Scottish Government and other partners to get the best deal for our councils and our local communities." A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "Scotland is facing the most challenging budget statement since devolution as a result of sustained high inflation and a UK Government autumn statement that failed to deliver the investment needed in Scotland's public services." The Scottish Government has increased the resources available to local government in 2023-24 by more than £793 million, a real terms increase of £376 million or 3% compared to the 2022-23 budget figures. Work is also ongoing with COSLA to establish a new fiscal framework for councils through the Verity House Agreement, a landmark agreement that is forging a stronger partnership between the Scottish Government and local councils through the spirit of collaboration and engagement. Decisions on local government budget allocations for future years are subject to the outcome of negotiations with COSLA, the results of which will be confirmed in future Scottish budgets. That article was by Lucy Garcia.
From The National, Monday the 4th of December, from the comments section. Labour are giving the left an ultimatum at the next general election, by columnist Steph Payton. Deep beneath Labour's London headquarters, there must surely be a room of forgotten things, a place for party relics to gather dust in the company of the infamous Ed Stone and boxes of unsold anti-immigrant mugs. There, in this dimly lit space, I believe you would find a thin, salmon-pink folder stamped with the title, "Things You Must Never Do as Leader of the Labour Party." Inside, a single sheet of typewritten paper listing the definitive do-nots of leadership, and sitting pretty above a reminder to always spell party founder Keir Hardie's name with an IE and never a Y. I believe you would see, in all capital letters, "Do not, under any circumstance, say you gotta hand it to Margaret Thatcher." Presumably somebody must have dug it out and finally passed it on to Keir Starmer, given how desperately he is now walking back his comments doing exactly that. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, Starmer praised the contentious Tory leader for having delivered meaningful change to Britain, which I can't deny that she did, in much the same way that a North Atlantic iceberg brought a meaningful change to the Titanic. Starmer, however, meant it as a compliment. Thatcher devastated communities across Scotland and well beyond. She privatised state-owned institutions, oversaw spiralling unemployment and defanged the trade unions. She is, in every meaningful sense, the antithesis to the founding principles of the Labour movement. For all the ways that Starmer has stamped his way across Labour's rich history of democratic socialism and working class advocacy, however, showing deference to the milk snatcher herself should obviously have been a line that should not have been crossed. But as a political spawn of Thatcher and her protege, Tony Blair, Starmer has shown no such care for the history, nor communities in his hands. Rather, all things that differentiated Labour from the Tories of yore have been eroded under his leadership. The Labour Party's foundational principles have been neatly filed away with the other forgotten things alongside the party's commitment to public ownership. Under Tony Blair, this seemed in service to centrism. Starmer, however, has pushed the party well and truly over the line into the centre-right, taking a party founded on the principles of economic equality to one that congratulates Thatcher for setting loose our natural entrepreneurialism. The legacy of what Thatcher set loose is still being felt today in ways big and small, not only in post-industrial communities, but in many of the modern failings of Britain. For example, Thatcher is the reason that the UK is so far behind the modern world in telecommunications. Through the 1970s to 1990s, British Telecom began manufacturing the fibre optic replacements to the copper wiring that was strangling digital communications at the time. BT oversaw a replacement scheme that led to the UK, at one point, allegedly having more fibre per capita than any other nation, and fibre to the home was becoming cheaper than the copper wiring it sought to replace. Thatcher killed it dead in 1990, declaring the system not to be competitive enough. The factories producing the components closed, the industry was suffocated, and, in turn, Britain struggled to get 2 Mbps download speeds, while Japan was already at 100 Mbps. This may seem like an odd example, but if you had just gone through the frustrating process of trying to get your copper line upgraded to fibre as I have, 50 years later than it should have been done, you will be looking for somewhere to vent to. The point is that Thatcher's supposed modernisation of the British economy wreaked significant long-term damage on the four nations stuck with our legacy, and, for a Labour leader in particular to praise it, seems coarse indeed. And that isn't to say that political parties should never change. The world changes and, in turn, we change with new information. The changes themselves, however, are where the criticisms lie. Both major political parties at Westminster being unable to find inspiration in the deeds of Margaret Thatcher is a declaration that the interests of the working class are irrelevant to Whitehall. Come the next election, Labour will not offer the left hand of comradeship, but an ultimatum. Vote Labour or let the Conservatives back in. Not really an endorsement of Labour's policies, more of a threat than anything else, a disdain for the public that is absolute. When Keir Starmer staunchly set himself to opposing a ceasefire in Gaza, the party machinery seemed content and puzzling over how much support from the Muslim community they could afford to lose without impacting a future election. They seemed far less concerned with whether the decision to tacitly endorse the ethnic cleansing of Palestine was right or wrong. But on counting votes, they never missed a beat. It's a numbers game, and Keir knows too well that his party can tack further to the right without losing too much support, while English voters have little option to turn elsewhere. And Scotland, as always, will be dragged through the horse and pony show without even the chance to change the outcome. And that article was by Steph Payton.
The National, recorded on 4th of December 2023. The Culture section. New documentary celebrates life and legacy of Alistair Gray, by Adam Robertson, multimedia journalist. A new documentary is helping to celebrate the life and legacy of iconic Scottish creative Alistair Gray, ahead of the release of the adaptation of his novel Poor Things. The latest work in Gray's life has been created by Jack O'Neill and Gavin Lundy, as part of their YouTube channel Ossian. The pair have already produced documentaries in Glaswegian architecture and debated Scotland's greatest footballing achievement, although say that this is their most ambitious project yet. It features interviews with Saoirse Dallas and Lorne Ford of the Alistair Gray Archive, his official biographer Rog Glass, and Scottish playwright Alan Bissett. Speaking to The National about why they chose Gray as the subject of their latest work, Lundy said, "I think we could still celebrate Alistair Gray, as much as those in the literary world have a deep appreciation for him. I think generally speaking, Scotland should celebrate our writers and our artists more. I would love to see Glasgow have the same relationship to Gray as Dublin has with Joyce." The new film, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, is tipped to receive a number of Oscar nominations. However, the film's non-Glaswegian setting has sparked some debate, as has the fact that none of its main characters are played by Scottish actors. As the news came out and I found out the adaptation has nothing to do with Glasgow, it didn't really compute with me, Lundy added. "I'm still excited for the film, but with this work we've done, I wanted to root it back in Glasgow and celebrate that connection and the way Gray shaped the city." Likewise, O'Neill stresses that the documentary is in no way critical of the film for its artistic choices, but rather intended to make people aware of where the source material comes from. "In no way do we want to denigrate the film.
It looks amazing, and I'm sure it deserves the acclaim that it's received. I honestly can't wait to see it, he said. However, he added that the fact that such a defining characteristic had been removed from the adaptation was disappointing. More broadly, he said, it pointed to a broader issue of Glasgow needing to be better represented on screen. It has, of course, doubled for various fictional and non-fictional cities, including in the recent Indiana Jones and Batman movies. I think Glasgow's the best city in the world. I want to see Hollywood talking about it and these Oscar-worthy films to be set in this city, O'Neill added. The idea of some punter in LA going to see a film about Glasgow is brilliant, and it's a shame this hasn't happened here. Lundy added, I think Scotland is used as a pretty backdrop, or Glasgow's used as a stand-in, but we seem to have this challenge of adapting and telling our own stories. We're a great literary culture, but I don't think we're celebrating that enough. I think often Glasgow can be reflected as this dilapidated place, and that just doesn't, to me, reflect reality. I think we've a vibrant culture, with some of the world's greatest architecture, and a heritage to be proud of, so there's a place to be looking at stories, celebrating the city and its unique attitude to life. O'Neill points out that Gray did more than just live in Glasgow. He was infatuated with the place. He celebrated this city, and I think it's only right we celebrate him in return. By Adam Robertson, The National, recorded on Monday, 4th of December, 2023. The Culture Section. Obituary. John Byrne, An Appreciation of a Multi-Talented Cultural Icon, by Mark Brown. Painter, playwright, screenwriter, draftsman, printmaker, muralist, book illustrator, set designer, costume designer, record cover designer, fashion icon. Enumerating the roles that John Byrne, who died last Thursday, November 30, at the age of 83, took up in Scottish and global culture, seems like listing the achievements not of one person, but of many. Born into a working-class Catholic family in Paisley in 1940, young John Patrick Byrne was an extremely talented autodidact, both with brush and pen, so much so that he was able to graduate from what he called the Technicolor hellhole of A.F. Stoddart & Co. in Paisley, where famously he worked as an underpaid and undervalued slab boy, mixing the colours for the carpets that the factory produced, to a place at the Glasgow School of Art. At art school, Byrne gained a tremendous sense of art history and of the many aesthetic movements to which it had given rise. Such was his immense skill that Byrne mastered every artistic style that he turned his hand to. This fact was made abundantly clear in the major, an overdue retrospective of his visual art titled John Patrick Byrne, A Big Adventure, which was held at the Kelvin Grove Art Gallery Museum in Glasgow earlier this year. Of course, there were paintings in the colourful, hyper-real style that many consider to be Byrne's signature visual aesthetic. These included pictures of the 1950s and 1960s youth who shared Byrne's fascination with the music and fashions of American rock and roll, blues and jazz. They encompassed two album covers for his fellow Paisley buddy and boyhood family friend Jerry Rafferty, and portraits of Byrne's pal Billy Connolly. However, that wonderful exhibition proved, beyond a shadow of doubt, that Byrne had no one signature style. Rather, he painted, drew, printed, and on occasion sculpted in an extraordinary range of aesthetics. His paintings of his wife, the theatre lighting designer Janine Byrne, and his former spouse, the actor and filmmaker Tilda Swinton, are imbued with similar warmth and affection, but the distinctiveness of the style suggests they were painted by different artists. Byrne's amazing diversity of artistic styles was also reflected in his often very humorous array of self-portraits, including a cubist picture of him puffing on a cigarette that one could swear had been painted by Picasso himself. The humour, colour and diversity of Byrne's visual art has probably led to him being undervalued in certain circles. However, as well as being technically brilliant, he was a thoughtful, humane, often deep and metaphorical, sometimes political painter, and he should be remembered as one of the finest visual artists Scotland has ever produced. Outstanding as his paintings and drawings are, it is surely Byrne's work as a dramatist that brought him the greatest public acclaim. The smash hit TV series Tutti Frutti, made by BBC Scotland and released in 1987, for which Byrne wrote the screenplays, is possibly his most celebrated work. Named after the song by Little Richard, rooted in Byrne's love of rock and roll, this multi-award winning comedy about the travails of touring Scottish band The Majestics is credited with launching the careers of Robbie Coltrane and Emma Thompson. The massive success of Tutti Frutti, was followed in 1990 by the acclaimed slice of Glasgow life drama Your Cheating Heart, which starred Tilda Swinton and John Gordon Sinclair. As a playwright, Byrne exhibited the same humour and human empathy that was so evident in his screen work and visual art. His articulation of Scottish working class modes of speech was so particular to him, so distinctively Byrne dialogue, that playwright David Gregg termed it an idiolect. That is to say that Byrne's characters speak in terms that belong simultaneously to both the writer's own dramatic idiom and to Scottish dialect. We find this in his excellent play Colquhoun and McBride, 1992, which is a sympathetic portrayal of the acclaimed Scottish painters who, as gay lovers in the 1940s and 1950s, lived and worked in a society that criminalised their very existence. The Byrne idiolect is at play marvellously in his stage adaptation of Tutti Frutti for the then new National Theatre of Scotland in 2006, and his most celebrated works for the stage, the Slab Boys trilogy. Premiering at the Traverse Theatre, Edinburgh, between 1978 and 1982, these three plays, The Slab Boys, Cutting a Rug and Still Life, offer a hilarious, poignant and insightful account of the lives of slab boys Phil and Spanky, and the great panoply of characters who cross their paths. So embedded is the trilogy in the fabric of Scottish theatre that the plays have enjoyed numerous revivals, including 40th anniversary stagings of all three at the Traverse in 2003. I had the great privilege and pleasure of interviewing Byrne on the stage of the Ramshorn Theatre in Glasgow in 2010, on the occasion of Strathclyde Theatre Group's production of The Slab Boys. It was a measure of Byrne's generosity that he was so supportive of the work of what was, in essence, an amateur company. His personal warmth and charm were apparent both on stage and off. Indeed, I was fortunate to experience Byrne's instinctive interest in and solidarity with others on every subsequent occasion in which I met him. Although to meet him was, however confidently one had stepped out the front door to feel entirely underdressed, Byrne had believed in the importance of personal style since his first encounters with slick back hair and rockabilly platform shoes in the 1950s. Whether he was wearing a frock coat and perfectly matching trousers, typically with an ornately designed scarf, or a three-piece tweed suit, Byrne was always the best-dressed man in the room. Byrne was as outrageously talented in paint and ink as he was in language. His work is, by turns, vivid, poetic, hilarious and heartbreakingly sad. We have lost an artist who was simultaneously, quintessentially Scottish, distinctively individual and powerfully universal. He was quite simply one of the greats of Scottish culture. By Mark Brown.
The National, recorded on Monday, 4th of December 2023. The Culture Section. Review, The Snow Queen is an Inventive Piece of Christmas Theatre, by Mark Brown. Edinburgh's Royal Lyceum is deservedly renowned for its staging of stylish, high-quality family theatre at Christmas time. This year, with writer Morna Young and director Cora Bissett's retelling of Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale, The Snow Queen, it has excelled itself. From the opening moments in which Edinburgh kids Gerda, brackets the likeable and heroic Rosie Graham, close brackets, and her best pal Kay, brackets Sebastian Limseat on relatable, vulnerable form, close brackets, are told the ancient stories of how Scotland's mountains came to be made by boulder-throwing giants. We know that the play, which is set in the Victorian era, is going to be a very Caledonian adventure. Claire Dargo's brilliantly chilly, and as is Scottish Yuletide tradition, posh English, Snow Queen, has ensnared the unfortunate Kay and spirited him away to her frozen lair in the Highlands. What follows is like a road and rail movie for the stage. The journey takes us, with Gerda, to Perth via the newly built Fourth Rail Bridge, through the Cairngorms and ultimately into the seas and glens of the far north of Scotland. As Gerda makes her intrepid way, sworn to rescue her beloved Kay, she makes a variety of colourful friends. One of them, Samuel Pashby's athletic Corby, is, unbeknownst to Gerda, the right-hand bird of the Snow Queen. However, the others, including Naomi Stirrett's hilarious and wonderfully ferocious Cairngorms bandit Senga, are true friends. Senga lends Gerda her horny horse, a.k.a. Hamish the Unicorn. This fabulous creature, who is pink, preening and prone to double entendres, is played with delightful cheekiness by Richard Conlon.
when he isn't singing his very funny signature song, A Horse with a Horn, which is just one of 14 superb songs written for the show by Finn Anderson and Young herself. The Frisky Unicorn is entertaining us with his decidedly risky line and humour. The combination of the tremendous songs and Young's clever, regularly hilarious writing is a winning one. Gerda's surreal encounter with a bunch of fantastically costumed flowers is a case in point. Director Bissett has assembled a universally top-rate cast, including Wendy Seeger and Anthony Strachan. Marvellous both as grandparents to Gerda and Kay, and as enchanted Highland royalty and enemies of the Snow Queen. Indeed, one might have said the production is perfect, were it not for Emily James's ornate but deeply disappointing set design. Although James's costumes impressed throughout, her choice, sadly accepted by Bissett, to recreate on stage a mirror image replica of the facade of the Lyceum's Grand Circle is a disastrous one. If it is a cinematic connection to the Anderson story, which begins with the smashing of a mirror, it is a very weak one. More importantly, as it is built just a few feet above the stage, the set forces actors to crouch down when leaving and entering the stage, a pointless and no doubt expensive distraction. This ill-conceived piece of scenography is never in tune with what is otherwise an outstanding and wonderfully inventive piece of Christmas theatre. Until December 31, lyceum.org.uk by Mark Brown.
From the National, Tuesday the 5th of December, from the comments section. Tories prefer scare stories over facts when it comes to immigration. Article by Shona Craven. Call me paranoid, but when I'm sitting in a TV studio with a microphone clipped to my lapel, I tend not to engage in much chit-chat. Best to keep focused on the task ahead and hod my weesht. On a recent visit to Sky News in London to review the weekend newspapers, my co-reviewer had no such qualms. In between segments, she was keen to natter with the presenter about the stories we had just covered and the ones we were planning to look at next. Given she's a former tabloid editor and GB News regular, when the chat turned to immigration, my ears pricked up. The presenter was herself an immigrant, and as they discussed the latest figures showing net migration into the UK of 745,000 in 2022, considerably higher than previous estimates, I feared things might go pear-shaped. I chimed in to observe that, having read the breakdown of the figures, there appeared to be a gulf between the facts and the political rhetoric. When the UK government declares that immigration is far too high, it doesn't follow up by saying there are too many international students at UK universities. When Labour chime in to call for the level of immigration shockingly high, they don't rail against foreigners coming to the UK to fill vacancies in the NHS. They are happy for the message to simply be that there are too many immigrants. To read many tabloid newspapers, indeed many broadsheets too, could be forgiven for believing that in 2022, 745,000 people must have come to the UK via small boats. The Tories don't want immigration to be discussed in a measured way. They want to ramp up concerns about illegals and then, once emotions are running high, lump a few other groups of people into the category of undesirables. It doesn't really matter what the long-term consequences might be for the economy or society. In fact, with a general election looming, it might serve the Tories' interest if even the medium-term consequences are dire. Last month, Home Secretary James Cleverly described foreign students as valuable people who were among our most successful exports, but in the summer, his government tightened the rules to stop them bringing family members with them to the UK. Does he imagine postgraduate students with dependent relatives will simply ditch them and come regardless, or does he expect a different cohort to take their place? If universities fail to attract the same numbers, is that a price worth paying for the chance to trumpet a falling immigration? Back at Sky, behind-the-scenes scrutiny of the day's papers resumed. The front page of the Times quoted Cleverly declaring that his government's Rwanda policy was not the be-all and end-all when it came to stopping small boat crossings and asserting that the UK leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, as desired by his predecessor Suella Braverman, was the wrong approach and indeed would be counterproductive. I was lulled into a false sense of security. Were we perhaps entering a new era of rational discussion of UK immigration, in which the Tories would tone down the dehumanising language and perhaps even start highlighting some positives? Writing in The Guardian in May, economist Jonathan Ports observed that the end of free movement had reduced the flow of lower skilled workers in some UK sectors, while substantially increasing those coming to work in the NHS. The provisional immigration figures for 2022 reflected, he said, a successful policy implemented efficiently and effectively and, even rarer, the crystallisation of a genuine Brexit opportunity. This could actually have been a good news story. Alas, the Tories prefer a scare story. Back in the studio, our on-air discussion of immigration began. Despite the measured earlier exchanges, my co-reviewer caught me off guard by declaring the revised 2022 figures terrifying. I sputtered that I was not terrified of overseas students, or indeed health and care workers, but she had made her point by lobbing that word into the mix with no words of justification. Would viewers have been engaged by a more prolonged follow-up discussion about the dependence of foreign postgraduate students, or care workers? What power have boring facts in the face of extreme feelings such as terror? Cleverly wants us to believe that foreign workers will keep coming to the UK to plug the huge gaps in our care sector, regardless of what barriers we put in their place. Indeed, the suggestion is that we are generous to allow them to assist us in this way, and right to view with suspicion anyone who wants to pull a fast one by bringing any undesirables, i.e. their own children, along with them. Unison's Christina Macania says banning them from doing so will be an utter disaster, and it's hard to disagree. Of course, I came up with my zinger of a retort too late. A truly terrifying impact of immigration policy would be people abandoned without care of staff shortages deliberately created by politicians who are more concerned about scary numbers than scary realities. That was a comment piece by Shona Craven.
The National News on Wednesday, the 6th of December. Patients still waiting too long in A&E, according to Michael Matheson. An article written by Jane McLeod. Too many patients are still spending too long in hospital accident and emergency departments, the health secretary said, as the latest figures showed more than 6,000 patients spent more than 12 hours there in October. While the Scottish Government has set the target of having at least 95% of patients in A&E either admitted, transferred or discharged within 4 hours, the figures for October showed this happened only in just over two-thirds of cases. Of the 128,350 people who attended at A&E over the course of the month, 14,203, or 11.3%, were there for 8 hours or more. This includes 6,907, or 4.8%, of patients who spent at least half a day in A&E, the Public Health Scotland figures show. Opposition politicians warned the NHS was facing a potential catastrophe this winter, with the Tories branding the decline in performance in October as a terrifying indicator that worse is still to come. Health Secretary Michael Matheson, however, stressed that the latest figures showed the number of patients having long waits was 9.4% lower than it was in October last year. But he was also clear that the number of long delays remains too high, adding that the Scottish Government is working with NHS boards to try and improve performance. However, Scottish Tory health spokesperson Dr. Sandesh Gulhane said with 70% of patients having been seen within the four-hour target time in September, there had been a marked worsening in A&E waiting times, which he insisted was unacceptable. With winter looming, the Tory MSP added it was also a terrifying indicator that worse is still to come for patients and overstretched staff. Dr. Gulhane said, "It's appalling that around a third of patients are waiting longer than 4 hours to be seen, and almost one in 20 are waiting more than half a day, because we know that these delays lead to tragic and avoidable deaths. Our A&E wards can't cope with the huge demands placed on them, and the buck for that stops with the dire workforce planning of a succession of SNP health secretaries." Meanwhile, Labour health spokesperson Jackie Bailey warned, "Our NHS is headed towards potential catastrophe this winter, but the SNP is distracted by its own sleaze." She added, years of failed workforce planning by the SNP has created thousands of vacancies and let down hard-working NHS staff. A&E is stuck in a constant state of over-demand, putting lives at risk day in, day out. Separate figures for the week ending November the 26th showed 24,564 patients attended A&E over the 7 days, with 64.3% admitted, transferred or discharged within 4 hours. There was a total of 8,768 patients who spent longer than the target time in the emergency department, including 2,966 who were there for 8 hours or more, and 1,237 who waited a minimum of 12 hours. Scottish Lib Dem leader Alex Cole-Hamilton said, "Week after week we see long waits in Scotland's A&E departments, yet week after week the First Minister and Health Secretary fail to properly focus on tackling this crisis." Mr Matheson stated, "I am clear that A&E performance remains below the levels we all wish to see, and we continue to work closely with boards to support delivery of sustained improvements." He added that while the October figures showed a slight decrease in national performance, this was consistent with monthly trend seen in previous years, with England and Wales also seeing a decrease in performance for this period. Mr Matheson said, "Monthly performance remains higher than at the same period last year. The statistics for the month of October show that long waits are down by 9.4% compared to the same period last year. Nevertheless, the number of long delays remains too high, and we are working with boards to reduce these instances." An article written by Jane McLeod. The National News on Wednesday, the 6th of December. Scottish town named among the UK's happiest places to live by Rightmove. An article written by Andrew Smart. A Scottish town has been named one of the happiest places to live in the UK in a new list looking at the 20 top spots across the country. Galla Shields, which is located in the Scottish Borders, was the only Scottish entry on the index, with the east of England being the happiest region in the country. Speaking of the Happy at Home index, Tim Bannister, Rightmove's property expert, said, "Searching for new areas outside of the city that are still commutable on office days and looking for cheaper properties that are in need of renovation are just some of the actions we've seen determined movers take this year. The results of this year's study highlights that residents continue to value living near green spaces and natural beauty, features that became all the more important during the pandemic. With moving to an area that makes them happy, a key motivator for people looking for their next home, highlighting these types of features nearby could really help sellers looking to appeal to potential buyers." The town was named among the UK's happiest places to live, with the location coming in at 15 on the Rightmove list. The Scottish Borders town was also found to be the cheapest on the list, with an average house asking price of £163,634. Rent was also found to be the cheapest in the index, with an average asking rent of £700 per calendar month. Speaking of Galla Shields' entry on the list, Adam James, director at James Agent in the Scottish Borders, said, "Galla Shields is the hub of the Scottish Borders, with something to love for every resident. The friendly people, strong community and good value for money means it remains popular with families each year, while the university, good choice of entertainment and job opportunities also makes it a favourite among younger people too. This is reflected in the different types of homes for sale. Galla Shields has everything from large Victoria-era homes to affordable flats for first-time buyers. We also see a number of buyers making the journey up from the south to settle in Galla Shields, attracted by the rural location and peaceful lifestyle on offer. Nothing quite beats some of the rural walks on offer in Galla Shields and other locations in the Borders. Over the last couple of years, we've seen the popularity of the area rise even further with the introduction of the Waverley line, which makes transport to Edinburgh much easier. So not only do residents of Galla Shields have everything they could want on their doorstep, but for those also looking for some of the attractions of the larger city, they can get that too." An article written by Andrew Smart. The National, Politics, on Wednesday, the 6th of December. 1 year on, and I'm still waiting for the Prime Minister to give a straight answer. An exclusive interview written by Xander Elliott. Stephen Flynn has been the SNP's Westminster group leader for 1 year today, but he's still waiting to get a straight answer from the Prime Minister. In taking the top role in the SNP's London group, the Aberdeen South MP says he became Scotland's voice in the Commons, hitting TV screens across the UK with his appearance at Prime Minister's Questions each week. But Mr Flynn said he goes into each Prime Minister's question session knowing that Rishi Sunak's answers, or their absence, won't be the most important thing. Look, you know he's not going to answer all the questions, so it's about making sure that the public is listening to what you're saying and that you're making the strongest possible case, he said. It's often important to listen to what he does say because it can be very dismissive of what is an important issue. That doesn't do the public any favours, and I don't think it does him any favours either. The moment I can get straight answers from the Prime Minister is one that I'll revel in. I don't think we have quite got to that point yet. Mr Flynn was elected to lead the SNP group on December the 6th last year, following weeks of speculation of behind-the-scenes plots to oust the incumbent Ian Blackford. But Mr Flynn insists he only thought about taking on the group leader role when there was a vacancy, after Mr Blackford's resignation on December the 1st. Asked when he first heard his name linked to the position, he said, "I'll be honest with you, I have absolutely no idea." In politics, your name gets bandied around all the time in relation to different things. You know, sometimes that can be quite nice, and other times you're wondering, how on earth did that appear in that context? Asked if he felt pressure in taking on the leadership role during his first term as a Westminster parliamentarian and in having the responsibility of questioning the Prime Minister each week, Mr Flynn said, "I think pressure is not knowing whether you can afford to pay your bills. Pressure is having to work multiple jobs to get by. Pressure is worrying to pay your mortgage or to afford the food bill or Christmas presents. That's pressure, and that's daily life for people in Scotland. My job is just to make sure that I stand up for them as best as I can." Asked for his reflections on his first year in charge, Mr Flynn said, "Things have gone so quickly over the course of the last 12 months. In general, on a personal level, it's been a huge privilege. The opportunity to do what I do on a weekly basis is something which gives me immense pride, and I'm grateful to my colleagues for putting their trust in me. On a professional level, which is much more important, I very much welcome the chance to be able to talk about the biggest issues impacting the people of Scotland on a daily basis. To hold this corrupt Tory government to account and to be able to be Scotland's voice on the cost of living crisis, on the situation in Gaza, on the mass public sector cuts which the Tories are forcing through, on migration and on Brexit as well. I often reflect upon the importance of having Scottish National Party MPs here, because if we weren't making the arguments that we are making, then nobody else would be. A Labour MP would simply fall in behind Sir Keir Starmer, as we've seen in recent weeks. A Tory MP would fall in behind the government, and a Lib Dem would probably find themselves sat on a fence somewhere. That's no use to anyone." As he moves into his second year at the helm of the SNP group at Westminster, Mr Flynn will be tasked with leading his MPs into their first test at the ballot box since 2019. With a general election expected in the autumn of 2024, the polls are not being overly kind to the SNP, on average predicting a significant loss of some 20 seats. Last week, polling expert Professor Sir John Curtis told The National that a crucial group in deciding the Scottish results of the next Westminster ballot, with a 15-20% of yes supporters who backed the SNP in 2019, but are unsure whether they will do so again. Asked if the connection between being a yes backer and an SNP voter had been broken, Mr Flynn said, "I don't see any evidence to back up that statement. You know, I think it's important in politics you don't take the electorate for granted. That's what the Labour Party did for generations. If you simply want to say, well, because you voted for someone in the past, you should always vote for them, then I think you're on a hiding to nothing. We need to be appealing to everyone in Scotland, making a positive case for why a vote for the SNP is so important and ultimately why independence is important. That's the challenge that's in front of us. Talking about the polls, Mr Flynn went on, we know two things. Firstly, we know that support for independence is roughly 50-50. That gives me a great deal of comfort, because we all, of course, want Scotland to be an independent nation. In relation to the party polling, I think it's quite clear that there's all to play for in certain parts for Scotland. I'm very confident that once we get into the midst of that general election, we'll be able to convince those people who may have swayed from the Scottish National Party to come back, because we are best placed to be their voice in Westminster, but also best placed to deliver that independent future. An exclusive interview written by Xander Eliads. The National News on Wednesday the 6th of December. Whisky strike on hold after a new pay offer. An article written by Ross Hunter. Workers at a whisky firm have suspended strike action planned for next week while a fresh pay offer is considered. Shivers Brothers workers at the Kilmallid, Dalmuir, Beath, Strathclydegrain and Strathyla distilleries, represented by Unite the Union, voted to strike by 91.2% as the company achieved best in a decade sales. Of the 1,500 workers employed by Shivers Brothers, around a third are members of Unite, and plans to strike were announced last week. A rolling programme of 24-hour stoppages across various Shivers Brothers facilities, including a warehouse in Dumbuck, West Dumbartonshire, between December the 11th to the 14th, had been planned. All industrial action is suspended until the ballot process on the new pay offer is complete. Shivers Brothers produces whisky, including Shivers Regal, Aberlour, Ballantine's, Royal Salute and the Glenlivet. Strikes had been expected across 21 sites, and an overtime ban and short-notice shift bans were also mooted. Unite members previously rejected a 6.4% pay offer by 97%. Inflation stood at 11.3% when the workers' pay increase should have been implemented. Shivers Brothers made a profit after tax of £168.5 million in 2022, described by Unite General Secretary Sharon Graham as eye-watering. In August, the company, owned by French firm Pernod Ricard, further announced that its July 2022 to June 2023 full-year net sales were up by 17%, taking total sales to a 10-year high. GMB Scotland, which also planned to take industrial action, warned it could disrupt orders to retailers, hotels and pubs over the holidays. Unite industrial officer Andy Brown said, Unite has been in intense negotiations with Shivers Brothers since we announced our rolling programme of strike action. Following the latest round of talks, we have agreed to put a new pay offer to our 500-strong Shivers Brothers membership for consideration. Unite has taken the decision to suspend all forthcoming industrial action until our membership has had the opportunity to vote on the merits of this new offer. Shivers Brothers was contacted for comment. An article written by Ross Hunter.
The National, Thursday the 7th of December, from the news section. Scotland weather, Met Office issues severe weather warnings, by James Walker. The Met Office has issued severe weather warnings across the UK as heavy rain is expected to continue falling on saturated ground. The organisation warned that journey times are likely to be made longer due to spray and flooding on roads, while bus and train services will probably be affected. It is also likely that some homes and businesses will experience flooding, as up to 80 millimetres of rain falls in some parts of the west of the UK. In Scotland, there are flood alerts for Fife, Tayside, Dumfries and Galloway, Dundee and Angus, Aberdeenshire and Aberdeen City. Neil Armstrong, chief forecaster at the Met Office, said, after a relatively calm day on Wednesday, wet and windy weather will move in from the west on Wednesday night. low pressure will drive several days of unsettled conditions, with heavy rainfall the main concern. We have issued a number of severe weather warnings for rain across the UK. As much as 80 millimetres of rain could fall in some areas of the west, particularly higher ground. Higher ground in eastern Scotland could even see up to 100 millimetres of rain. Our warnings are likely to be updated, so keep up to date with the Met Office forecast. The rain will be falling on already very wet ground, and where there is still lying snow in the northwest of England and parts of Scotland, snow melt will exacerbate the risk of flooding. It is important to check for flood warnings in your area issued by your local environment agency. Yellow weather warnings have been issued for Thursday in South West and South Wales, the Midlands, parts of Northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. The Met Office said areas of low pressure will bring wet and windy conditions, displacing the cold weather that has seen frosts, snow and ice in some regions. It is expected that the highest rain totals will be focused in western parts of the UK over the next few days, falling on already sodden ground. A second low pressure will see heavy rain through Thursday and further weather fronts during Friday and Saturday morning. There will then be a brief calmer spell in the southern half of the UK as a ridge of higher pressure moves in through Saturday afternoon, though showery rain will continue in the north, the Met Office said. Another area of low pressure could move close to Northern Ireland on Sunday, bringing strong winds and further spells of rain. There are currently 22 flood warnings and 111 flood alerts in place across England. In Wales, there is one flood alert for South Pembrokeshire. That is an article, Scotland Weather, Met Office Issues Severe Weather Warnings, by James Walker. The National, Thursday the 7th of December, from the news section. Scottish firm Baxter's confirms a number of job losses, by James Walker. The Scottish firm Baxter's Food Group have confirmed the number of staff layoffs. The 150-year-old Scottish firm, which produces food products such as canned soups and sauces, confirmed to the National that the company has made a number of staff layoffs due to unprecedented inflationary pressure, but didn't confirm the specific number. Now the company have done so, telling the National that less than 10 will be cut group-wide. This includes just the one redundancy at their headquarters in Foccabbers. A previous statement from Baxter's read, "Like many organisations, we are experiencing unprecedented inflationary pressures, which has impacted our business performance. As a result, we have made the difficult but necessary decision to make a small number of reductions within our workforce." Commenting before the numbers were known, local MSP Richard Lockhead said it was concerning, adding, "No doubt many workers and their families will be extremely worried, especially given the difficult financial situation and the pressure on household incomes at the moment. I'm aware that Baxter's have stated the layoffs were due to unprecedented inflationary pressure, which of course highlights the serious impact of the high inflation we've been experiencing across the UK in the last few years. I will be seeking clarity from Baxter's as to the nature of the job losses and will strongly urge them to ensure all options that prevents any job losses are fully explored." Local MP Douglas Ross said that given just one Foccabbers employee was losing their job, he didn't wish to comment. That was a story, Scottish firm Baxter's confirms a number of job losses, by James Walker.
This is from The National on Thursday, 7th December 2023. From the comment section. Joe Biden's foreign policy could cost him the election. By David Pratt. Conventional wisdom has it that US presidential races don't normally hinge on crisis in far-off lands. It suggests instead that the American electorate are much more inclined to vote with their pocketbooks. But as the wars in Gaza and Ukraine continue to dominate global headlines and Joe Biden oscillates between backing Israel one minute and chastising it the next, as well as seemingly taking his eye off the ball in Ukraine, both crises appear to be endangering his re-election. I'm not the only one, I bet, who finds it rich that the Biden administration has started finger-wagging at Benjamin Netanyahu's government, given that Washington effectively helped unleash Israel's dogs of war on the Palestinians in the first place. No amount of US support and munitions, it seemed, were too great in that initial flush of war when Biden gave Netanyahu the thumbs up to go seeking all-out revenge on the Palestinians, even if many have little truck with the toxic aberration that is Hamas. As the New York Times observed the other day, Biden banked credibility with Jerusalem to be spent on moderating its response in Gaza, only for the US president to find his account been drained and the checks beginning to bounce. Or, as one US official wryly put it, the Israelis are playing with house money. Not that Netanyahu's unsavoury coalition government will listen to any subsequent US chastisement. They rarely do. Sensing this, Biden has left it to his subordinates to deliver the tough messages in public to the Israelis. In recent days, Vice President Kamala Harris, remember her, has declared that Israel must do more to protect innocent civilians, while Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin delivered the assessment that Israel risks strategic defeat unless it protects Palestinians in Gaza. Talk about too little too late. Or perhaps a more appropriate metaphor would be running with the hare and hunting with the hounds. For many Americans, and indeed others, this is not how it was meant to be when Biden entered the White House. Here, after all, was a US president whose strong suit was supposed to be his experienced grasp of foreign affairs, and unlike his predecessor, Donald Trump, could be relied upon to steer a fairly consistent and stable course in terms of US foreign policy. To be fair to Biden, admittedly he and his team could not have foreseen the Hamas attack, given that the Israelis themselves apparently failed to do so. Nor earlier, almost 2 years ago now, could Biden's administration have banked on Vladimir Putin rolling Russia's tanks into Ukraine and since then doubling down on the war there. But as the saying goes, we are where we are. And for Biden, that now is a tricky place indeed when it comes to foreign policy and its repercussions back home in America, where he's about to be plunged into the throes of the mother of all US presidential elections. Both crises in Ukraine and Gaza are already directly feeding into American politics. According to a recent NBC News poll, fully 70% of US voters under 35 disapprove of Biden's handling of the Gaza crisis. Other polls, too, reveal that a majority of young voters do not support sending weapons to Israel. Biden cannot afford to ignore such figures, given that an issue like this could easily tip the scale in crucial swing states where razor-thin margins of victory are common. It's hardly surprising, then, that Biden's main Republican rival, Trump, has wasted no time in reminding the US electorate that Sleepy Joe is presiding over an administration caught napping. Not only have Trump and other Republican presidential hopefuls already started flagging up current failings over Gaza and Ukraine, but have sought to highlight earlier ones in Afghanistan and looming ones with China over the Taiwan Strait. There's nothing new, of course, for Democrats losing sleep over the electoral consequences of being pro-Israel. But Gaza aside for the moment, the precariousness of Ukraine's situation is getting less attention than it should because of the focus on the Middle East. Here too, Biden faces real challenges. Resupplied with many more drones and missiles, thanks to Iran and North Korea, the world can expect to see the Kremlin unleash its own fresh onslaught against Ukraine's infrastructure in the hope of crippling the country's power supply and winter heating. Moscow might not succeed last year, but Ukraine, after almost 2 years of a draining war, is a very different place right now. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky knows this better than most, just as he knows that the current level of US support is already in the balance. Just this week, Zelensky cancelled plans to appeal directly to US politicians for new aid, as a partisan battle over immigration policy threatened to derail Biden's latest request for billions of dollars for Kyiv. Republicans and even Biden's fellow Democrats in the Senate and House of Representatives have been debating for weeks over Biden's October request that Congress approve $106 billion for Ukraine, Israel, security at the US border with Mexico, and US interests in the Indo-Pacific. Funds for Ukraine, many argue, must be tied to transformative change in US immigration policy, further adding to Biden's foreign policy woes and their impact at home. Writing in the Los Angeles Times a few days ago, Mark Hanna, a senior fellow at the Institute for Global Affairs at the Eurasia Group and an expert on US foreign policy, observed how historically a foreign policy election often benefits the incumbent. Certainly, the Cold War international crises often generated a rally around the flag effect for leaders seen taking decisive action. But things are different for Biden. Voters today don't agree on the dangers the US faces, let alone the best way to address them, said Hanna, citing a recent survey entitled Order and Disorder, Views of US Foreign Policy in a Fragmented World. Where exactly the crisis in Gaza and Ukraine fit into all of this in terms of next year's election remains to be seen. In one sense, Biden is damned if he does and damned if he doesn't when it comes to US engagement on both issues. Certainly, a divisive US election with Trump or whoever wins the Republican nomination sniping at Biden over foreign policy will cause him considerable problems at home. Overseas, meanwhile, from Moscow to Beijing to Tehran, there will also be a rubbing of hands in glee at what will be seen as US weakness and decline. Whatever way you cut it politically, all this does not bode well for Biden, who, some ungraciously but not without accuracy, will argue that in part is of his own administration's making. That article was by David Pratt.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Tune Review and tell your friends about our service.